Following Dharma Talk is presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
So, welcome again, everybody. I was subbing for the Metta class about a week and a half ago, and I had all these wonderful materials about loving kindness and compassion that I never quite got to talk about. It just, the time disappeared. So I thought maybe I'd expand on this subject and bring in some of those materials tonight. So the subject of kindness and what we could also say failures of kindness. You know, we want to be kind, but we can't be kind. We don't know how to be kind. So kindness and failures of kindness. And there was a remarkable article in the New York Times. Maybe some of you saw it. It was about a commencement address that George Saunders gave at Syracuse University a few weeks ago. Yeah, so maybe some of you saw it. But it was quite lovely, and he was offering advice to the graduates. So it's just a few paragraphs. I'll read to you what he said. So George Saunders is an author. So he says to them, what do I regret? Being poor from time to time? Not really. Working terrible jobs, like knuckle puller in a slaughterhouse, and don't even ask what that entails. No, I don't regret that. Skinny dipping in a river in Sumatra, a little buzzed, and looking up and seeing like 300 monkeys sitting on a pipeline pooping down into the river. The river in which I was swimming with my mouth open, naked, and getting deathly ill afterwards and staying sick for the next 7 months. No, not much. Do I regret the occasional humiliation, like once playing hockey in front of a big crowd, including this girl I really liked? I somehow managed, while falling, emitting this weird whooping noise, to score on my own goalie, while also sending my stick flying out into the crowd, nearly hitting the girl. Says, no, I don't even regret that. But here's something I do regret. In seventh grade, this new kid joined our class. In the interest of confidentiality, her convocation speech name will be Ellen. Ellen was small, shy. She wore these blue cat-eyed glasses that, at the time, only old ladies wore. When nervous, which was pretty much always, she had a habit of taking a strand of hair into her mouth and chewing on it. So she came to our school and our neighborhood and was mostly ignored, occasionally teased. Your hair tastes good? That sort of thing. I could see this hurt her. I still remember the way she'd look after such an insult, eyes cast down, a little gut-kicked, as if having just been reminded of her place in things. She was trying, as much as possible, to disappear. After a while, she'd drift away, hair strands still in her mouth. At home, I imagined, after school, her mother would say, you know, how was your day, sweetie? And she'd say, oh, fine. And her mother would say, making any friends? And she'd go, sure, lots. Sometimes I'd see her hanging around alone in her front yard as if afraid to leave it. And then they moved. That was it. No tragedy, no big final hazing. One day she was there, next day she wasn't. End of story. Now why do I regret that? Why, 42 years later, am I still thinking about it? Relative to most of the other kids, I was actually pretty nice to her. I never said an unkind word to her. In fact, I sometimes, even mildly, defended her. But still, it bothers me. So here's something I know to be true, although it's a little corny and I don't quite know what to do with it. What I regret most in my life are failures of kindness. Those moments when another human being was there in front of me, suffering, and I responded sensibly, reservedly, mildly. It's a little facile, maybe, and certainly hard to implement, but I'd say, as a goal in life, you could do worse than try to be kinder. So, I think, you know, we can all relate to that, right? We can relate to things from our childhood, those little stains in our heart, ways that which we acted that we wish we hadn't, you know, and how they can live on in us. The Buddha said that we're actually wired to discern the wholesomeness of kindness and the unwholesomeness of unkindness. Like, this is something that we know. This is something that we come into the world with. And he has this phrase, maybe some of you have heard of it. It's hiri otapa, hiri otapa. So hiri means wholesome shame. So I think that's what George Saunders was feeling after these 42 years, that what is that feeling that stayed with him in his heart? What is that sticky thing? And we can say it's a wholesome shame, an instructive shame, that this didn't feel good. And hiri, wholesome shame, leads to wholesome fear or caution. Hiri otapa, otapa is the wholesome fear. Through this shame, we learn, this is instructive, you don't want to act in that way. So that's called wholesome fear. So shame and fear are generally words that have really negative connotations for all of us, but I think there's a subtle meaning to the way in which the Buddha was talking about this, hiri otapa. And I heard Upandita talk about this in a talk about 15 years ago, and it was so powerful to me, just this concept, you know, of using these moments of shame as instructive instead of sort of guilt, or, you know, like instead of the ways we can just berate ourselves, you know, those old habits, but instead it's just absolute clarity. Ah, you know, so now sometimes I'm grateful when something comes up and I see it clearly. Ah, now I see that, and now I'll be careful next time. I'll be careful about that. So hiri otapa. And I thought, it might be grounding for this talk to just spend just a few moments, like maybe a minute or two, recalling in our lives different situations. So I want you to shut your eyes. I'll just kind of take you through. So just settling into your body. And let's start with just a moment where someone was unkind to you. It could have been today. It could have been from your childhood. And don't struggle with which thing. Just whatever first comes into your mind, just let that be there. And just let your mind and heart open to that moment, the images, the words, the feelings, a moment when someone was unkind. And just taste that moment. Okay, and in a way that's just really soft and open, non-judgmental, let's recall a time in our lives when we were unkind, whether through stress or confusion or ignorance, whatever it was that led to that moment of unkindness. And maybe it was today, and maybe it was a long time ago, just whatever first comes to your mind, a moment where there was a failure of kindness. And now let's think of a moment where we were met with kindness, maybe unexpectedly, something out of the blue. We had some kind of need, and we were met with kindness. And taste that. How does that feel in the heart? Even if it was just an interaction with a cat or a squirrel. And finally, remembering a moment when we were kind. Maybe it was a spontaneous moment. Maybe it was a moment that took a lot of effort beforehand, a lot of deliberation. But there was a moment of kindness, of meeting someone with our kind heart. So some of the Buddha's words on kindness are quite radical, and I thought I'll just put them into the space and we can have a discussion at the end and talk about how we relate. The first one I'll read is called Simile of the Saw. This is very short. The Blessed Buddha once said, "Friends, even if bandits were to cut you up savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, you should not be angry with them, but do my bidding. Remain pervading them with a friendly mentality imbued only with an all-embracing goodwill, kind, rich, expansive, and immeasurable. Free from hostility, free from ill will, always remembering the simile of the saw is indeed how you should train yourselves." That's a tall prayer. And here's another lovely one from the Dhammapada. We are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. With our thoughts, we make the world. Speak or act with a pure mind, and happiness will follow you as your shadow, unshakable. Look how he abused me and beat me. Look how he threw me down and robbed me. Live with such thoughts, and you live in hate. Look how he abused me and beat me, how he threw me down and robbed me. Abandon such thoughts and live in love. In this world, hate never yet dispelled hate. Only love dispels hate. This is the law, ancient and inexhaustible. So thought it would be interesting to... I'll reflect myself on an example of working with... just a small example of a difficult state of heart and how I worked with it. And maybe at the end of, you know, tonight we can have a little discussion about, you know, these afflictive mind states when they arise. Can they be transformed? How can they be transformed? How do we work with that? So I'll just give an example I gave the other night. Some time ago, I was on retreat, and this was a very long and intensive retreat where, if you've ever been on a retreat, it's alternate sitting and walking meditation all day long. So it's your world becomes your mind. You know, this is where you live, sort of in your mind and in your heart. And all that becomes of intense interest. And because over time the mind settles, you can see more in detail. So sometimes I give examples from retreat because in my daily life often I'm in survival mode. But, you know, in retreat I kind of have the wherewithal to, it's more simple. I'm just sitting in stillness, right? The environment is simplified. So I can pay attention to the mind. I can pay attention to sensations in the body. And I can remember things that I want to remember. So on this particular retreat, one of the teachers his Dhamma talks were really hard, where they were hard for me. I was feeling like this isn't the Dhamma. This is dogmatic. This is dismissive of other wisdom traditions. This is, you know, I had a lot of this going on, and I had a lot of assessments about what was wrong with this teacher. And but fortunately, you know, because I was on retreat and because I recognized right away that this feeling doesn't serve me, you know, not that I can't see clearly or not that I can't, you know, have an open mind as to what's going on, but the hatred, the ill will, the judgment, that's a different story. So that's what needs to be seen and attended to. So I was aware, okay, Wynn, this is like, you know, this is anger, this is afflictive, and you're suffering here. And so have that acronym, maybe if you've been here before, RAIN, R-A-I-N. So the first thing, of course, recognize, I'm angry, that's what's going on. And not to be flinching about it. You know, sometimes when we're judgmental or we're angry, we can, you know, that it's like, that's not me. And we can shy away and not attend because we don't like what we see. This is deeply habituated in our consciousness, this reaction when we, parts of ourselves that come up that we don't respect. So the impulse needs to be the opposite. We need to say, ha, you know, hiriyotaba, like, what's here? What's here? Isn't this interesting? So we recognize and we accept. Radical acceptance, like non-judgmental. If we judge everything that comes up, we will get so mired. So, because when you're sensitive and you see everything, you see how much is there. And so you just have to have a lot of space, a lot of acceptance. So total acceptance. Okay, when this is anger coming up. And also, now in my practice, I recognize that it's these moments of suffering, these moments of difficulty that are also the possibility for moments of liberation. They are the same doorway. And I keep learning that again and again. When we want to run from our suffering, but we move to it because that's where the freedom is. They are the same pivot point. So knowing these things, I'm really direct. I don't mess around with my mind. I don't suppress. It's like, okay, you know, you're angry. And so mindfulness of mind, what are the thoughts that are happening? So just noticing this little loop of thoughts that are going around and around, noticing the sensations that are happening in the body, moving through the body. And this time it was interesting. I was particularly aware of how anger was manifesting in my face and the energy behind my face. My face, which was outwardly serene and, you know, whatever, but inwardly I had one of those kabuki faces, maybe really, you know, and kabuki is this wonderful art form. There's a moment in kabuki where an actor will arrest with the most intense rage. This is called cutting a mi, where they'll stay there for as long as 3 minutes, and they will hold the energy of anger, their eyes cross, and they're, you know, there's all this kind of energy happening in the face, and they keep it alive, and so that flash, it's like, I'm cutting a knee as I'm sitting here. And it was distasteful. It was like, this is ugly, this energy behind my, it's ugly, this energy, you know. And also having a lot of serenity where I was getting used to the taste of sort of softness and openness, so that congealing of anger was really clear, and it had a distinct feel that I wanted to drop. You know, it's like when you feel like that image of the hot coal, you're holding a hot coal, it hurts, you drop it. And sometimes we can, you know, even though it hurts, you know, we can. And so in this case, you know, it didn't drop right away. Even though I kind of was feeling it, even though I saw it was unskillful, it didn't drop. So it took the next step of inviting in compassion for myself. Like, you're having a hard time, Wynn. And this is like a small example. It wasn't huge, but it was small enough that I could pay attention to it. I could really pay attention without getting, you know, unhinged. So, where was I?
Compassion for yourself.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Yes, okay. So, compassion for myself. And with touching that suffering, I also opened the door to this teacher, like getting, I'm sure that he really suffered in his life too. And on this retreat, a lot of those childhood injuries kind of came up. They just sort of naturally were floating to the surface, so that was very alive in me. And so I just naturally started to reflect, I bet when he was a kid, he had a hard time. I bet he didn't make friends easily. I bet, you know, this kind of personality. And so I let my mind be creative. I let myself reflect, even though I really didn't know anything about him. But I used that to let my heart soften, to kind of relax. And that did the trick, you know. When I really touched my own pain, I could open to his, whatever it was. You know, if we could all wear our injuries on our sleeves, we wouldn't want to be anything but kind to each other, right? I mean, really. So just kind of feeling that in that moment. And then the next day when I went to interview with him, I was so happy because there wasn't all this mud. Like in the past, I know how I've proliferated in my self-righteousness, you know, kind of gone on and on and on about how, you know, they're to blame and I'm right. And then what that leads to, like if I had done that, I would have been a very different person moving into that interview than I was with a very, you know, as it was, I turned it up with just a lot of softness and fearlessness. I wasn't afraid of anything he might say. I didn't have to strategize or defend myself or anything. It was just wide open. I just was very focused on giving a clear, direct report. And but there was also a little joyous energy of like anything could happen here, you know, like anything could happen. I'm in a clear place and I'm wide open to this person, this phenomenon of body, thought, and image kind of right in front of me. So that was a really beautiful alchemy that I discovered in a really, really simple way. This contracted, angry heart, I kind of went through a process, and then I showed up, and it was completely different. It really gives me faith of the power of mindfulness, of the power of attention. And the Buddha said, you know, when the three poisons of hatred and greed and ignorance are uprooted, that kindness is the natural state of mind. It's kindness. It's not like empty neutrality. It's kindness. Isn't that hopeful? I think that's beautiful. And I'll just add one more thought. You know, on the bigger examples, when it's harder to let go, like with my husband, when we've got our horns locked, and I'm sure everybody knows this experience, whether it's with your kid or your parent or partner, whoever, horns are locked, nothing is moving, we're just all stuck in our whatever. It's just mud and it's painful and that's difficult. So we all know that. And in spite of all my skill, all my incentive to let things go, the attachment is just stronger than the wisdom in those moments. And so I can always invite that compassion. I can always get when you're hurting and he's hurting. And I can just hold the space with a big heart and know that that's happening. And that itself is a big deal, just to be able to invite that into this really immovable, difficult space. And then lately, not that this happens all the time, but in a recent time, the other thing that happened was that there was a deep despair that came up in that moment of locking horns, like a deep despair, and I just let it flower. I just come off retreat, and so I was in the habit of not running away, but just like really letting things flower. And so I just was, oh, this is despair. This is how it feels in body. This is despair. You know, like kind of just, wow, you know. And it was so humbling. I feel like when we touch pain, when we touch suffering, it makes us humble. It's like sobering. Like, this is part of our human experience. Because we can, you know, we can be on our coffee and we can, you know, be in this mode where we don't touch that sometimes. And then I forget. It's like, oh, yeah, I forgot. This is what it feels like. And then it just sort of open wides that kind of compassion and empathy for all people in the world that are in despair, and there are plenty, you know. So there's some wisdom that can come, I think, in just connecting with those moments of suffering. I heard once, and I wish I knew where it was from, I think it was a Jewish saying that said, "We lay the teachings on the heart. When the heart breaks, the teachings fall in." I love that. And I thought before we talk together, I'd read another example of this alchemy. I was on retreat recently with Marcia Rose, and she read a little bit from this book. It's called On the Res by Ian Frazier. It was written in 2000, but he spent time on the Pine Ridge Sioux Indian Reservation in South Dakota. And one of his heroes from his time there was a young woman, Sue Ann Big Crow was her name. And so he tells stories about her, and I just found them really moving and powerful. So I'll just read this very short, just read a little bit. So it gives some background. So when Sue Ann was nine, when she was 9 years old, she was staying with her godmother on New Year's Eve when the woman's teenage son came home drunk and shot himself in the chest. The woman was too distraught to do anything, so Sue Ann called the ambulance and the police and cared for her until the grown-ups arrived. Perhaps because of this incident, Sue Ann became as opposed to drugs and alcohol as her mother was. She gave talks on the subject to school and youth groups, made a video urging her message in a stern and wooden tone, and as a high schooler traveled to distant cities for conventions of like-minded teens. I once asked Roel Bradford, a Pine Ridge teacher and coach who was also a friend of her family, whether Sue Ann's public advocacy on this issue wasn't risky given the prominence of alcohol in the life of the reservation. "You have to understand," Roel Bradford said, "Sue Ann didn't respond to peer pressure. Sue Ann was peer pressure. She was the backbone of any group she was in, and she was way wiser than her years." And Sue Ann was a basketball player on the Pine Ridge team. They were called the Lady Thorpes. And he talks about one example, something that she did. When teams from Pine Ridge play non-Indian teams, The question of race is always there. When Pine Ridge is the visiting team, usually their hosts are courteous, and the players and fans have a good time. But Pine Ridge coaches know that occasionally, at away games, their kids will be insulted. Their fans will not feel welcome. The host gym will be dense with hostility, and the referees will call fouls on Indian players every chance they get. Sometimes in a game between Indian and non-Indian teams, the difference in race becomes an important and distracting part of the event. One place where Pine Ridge teams used to get harassed regularly was in the high school gymnasium in Lead, South Dakota. In the fall of 1988, the Pine Ridge Ladythorpes went to Lead to play a basketball game. Sue Ann was a full member of the team by then. She was a freshman, 14 years old. Getting ready in the locker room, the Pine Ridge girls could hear the din from the fans. They were yelling fake Indian war cries, a woo, woo, woo sound. The usual plan for the pregame warm-up was for the visiting team to run onto the court in a line, take a lap or two around the floor, shoot some baskets, and then go to their bench at courtside. After that, the home team would come out and do the same, and then the game would begin. Usually, the Thorpes lined up for their entry, more or less according to height, which meant senior Donnie DeCorey, one of the tallest, went first. As the team waited in the hallway, leading from the locker room, the heckling got louder. The Lead fans were yelling epithets like squaw and gut eater. Some were waving food stamps, a reference to the reservations receiving federal aid. Others yelled, "Where's the cheese?" The joke being that if Indians were lining up, it must be to get commodity cheese. The Lead high school band had joined in with fake Indian drumming and a fake Indian tune. Donnie DeCorey looked out the door and told her teammates, "I can't handle this." Sue Ann quickly offered to go first in her place. She was so eager that Donnie became suspicious. "Don't embarrass us," Donnie told her. Sue Ann said, "I won't. I won't embarrass you." Donnie gave her the ball, and Sue Ann stood first in line. She came running onto the court, dribbling the basketball with her teammates running behind. On the court, the noise was deafeningly loud. Sue Ann went right down the middle, but instead of running a full lap, she stopped suddenly when she got to center court. Her teammates were taken by surprise, and some bumped into one another. Coach Zemiga at the rear of the line did not know what had happened. Sue Ann turned to Donnie DeCorey and tossed her the ball. Then she stepped into the jump ball circle at center court in front of the Lead fans. She unbuttoned her warm-up jacket and took it off, draped it over her shoulders, and began to do the Lakota shawl dance. Sue Ann knew all the traditional dances. She had competed in many powwows as a little girl, and the dance she chose is a young woman's dance, graceful and modest and show-offy all at the same time. "I couldn't believe it. She was like powwowing, like, 'Get down,'" Donnie DeCorey recalled. And then she started to sing. Sue Ann began to sing in Lakota, swaying back and forth in the jump ball circle, doing the shawl dance, using her warm-up jacket for a shawl. The crowd went silent. All that stuff the Lead fans were yelling, it was like she reversed it somehow, a teammate said. In the sudden quiet, all you could hear was her Lakota song. Sue Ann stood up, dropped her jacket, took the ball from Donnie DeCorey, and ran a lap around the court, dribbling expertly and fast. The fans began to cheer and applaud. She sprinted to the basket, went up in the air, and laid the ball through the hoop, with the fans cheering loudly. "It was funny," Donnie DeCorey said, "but after that game, the relationship between Lead and us was tremendous. When we played Lead again, the games were really good, and we got to know some of the girls on the team. We found out there were some really good people in Lead." And Ian Fraser, our author, he calls this one of the coolest and bravest deeds I ever heard of. So this, to me, is an alchemy of a difficult situation, which was approached with a fresh mind and an open heart, and it allowed creativity to happen and a positive response that changed the flow, the energy, the direction of where things were going. So I find myself really inspired by that, you know, because we can so easily fall into self-righteousness and hatred and judgment. You know, we all know that. We all do that. And to somehow lead with wisdom, like to me, that it's not only a kind of kindness, a fullness of heart, there's a wisdom that recognizes what needs to happen. So I think there's that image of to fly, we need one wing of love or kindness and one wing of wisdom. Like they go together. Right? They have to be in the to make that bird take off. So I have one more story, but maybe we can do that at the end if there's time. Maybe we can just open it up and, you know, reflect on our own moments of alchemy, or our own failures of kindness, or our own views. You know, that's as important to anything as anything. Like, do we cherish our anger? Do we feel like our anger serves us? Are there times when we feel that it serves us? And these are real questions because we, you know, obviously they affect how we think, they affect how we behave. There's kind of no right or wrong in this group. This is just like an exploration, but we can just reflect together. And I feel like we can respond to each other also. I'm up here as a spiritual friend, and there's great wisdom in this room as a whole, so we can see this more as a big discussion. But, you know, with your earlier reflections or any questions or thoughts that come to mind. Yeah.
I just had to share something. I've worked with young children for most of my life, and I think that kindness, even though children's behavior can be out of control, but that basic kindness, I think, is there. You know, an 8 or 9 month old will get a very sad look and even start crying if another baby is crying. And a toddler, if someone is upset, will take a stuffed animal and bring it to them. And anyway, so I think it's not always something we have to learn. I think it's in there.
Thank you.
I really appreciate your talk. I appreciate the subject of kindness. It's something that I've been exploring a lot recently, is like being kind to myself. And I found the more I struggle with being kind to myself, the less I'm able to do that for others, and the less that I'm able to offer kindness to others because I'm just not out here. I think it's a really hard thing to do in our culture to naturally extrovert ourselves when there's so much focus on what you should do to improve the interior and the exterior too. So it's just kind of goes back to, you know, we have to be able to take care of ourselves and really nurturing and nourishing to ourselves
and
we can be there.
Yeah, I think the Buddha said something like, there's no one that deserves our kindness more than ourselves, something like that.
And we're least likely to give it to ourselves.
At least here, culturally. Thank you.
It was about 20 years ago, almost exactly, I think, that I first sat at Spirit Rock, and of course, I was reading Jack Kornfield's book and reading what he did at the beginning about taking the Wasi. Really resonated with any shoot for that. And it seems like being there and not being sideways and strategizing is sort of foundation from which kindness is. like.
It's for me really difficult because I had such a bad childhood that it's like there's pain in there that, oh, it's just like a heart attack, it's just so heavy. And I'm able to show them to be kind, but it's like, oh, I just wish it would go away. Like, I wish they could walk through it and face it, which I do. But then there's no like ending point. Like, why will I be through it?
Because it's so deep. Yeah. Yeah, I think patience is, like, central to this path. Like, if we learn patience, we've learned everything. Really. Yeah.
It makes it very difficult then to show up and be kind to people. Because I think that's who I naturally am.
Yeah.
But when something happens, it's somehow, like, replicates what happens to me or here, what happens to a child, and it's like, hold up, you know, oh,
yeah.
Oh no, I don't want this to happen. Like,
yeah.
So it makes it very
difficult. Yeah, and that's okay. I mean, this can just be treated with mindfulness, I mean, with investigation, like being wide open to whatever process, whatever natural response because of your conditioning. You know, it's okay. So part of the path is understanding. Part of the path is just seeing clearly the conditions that are at work in your mind and in your heart. So just kind of holding the space and let it play out, you know, just as it needs to play out. Don't need to interfere. Don't need to fix. Just a big, patient heart that just can pay attention. You know, it's that sense of investigation can be a real, if nothing else, you know, we can observe.
I think in thoughts too, like you said, this is my last comment, but it's like for me when I start on those thoughts, it's like going down the rabbit hole. And it's like, if I don't stop that, it'll continue to happen.
Yeah.
Or trying to be aware of those thoughts.
Yeah. And there's a tricky, you know, in both the meditation at the beginning, you know, I had mentioned about letting thought be a subject of attention. So thought is tricky to keep space around thought. You know, we can get like swallowed in, like I think you said, a black hole or a rabbit hole. That's actually kind of feels like the way it is. We just kind of, and we are gone. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so that's a training too, you know, that's why we sit in simplicity so we can just see us fall down the hall over and over and over again and retrain.
Okay. You might have any thoughts on how to deal with anger personally, because I feel like a lot of times when you have about anger, you like to push it to the side, you like to say, anger is useful, anger is helpful. Drop it right away, but I feel like when we do that a lot of times, we're not really paying attention to how, why the anger is there and using that as like how something can change. But one thing that I particularly struggle with in my life is right now I'm in a moment of real anger, and I'm struggling with that, being mindful and aware of the anger that I'm having in this moment, but at the same time, how to use that as a catalyst, but how to use that wisely, because I feel like I don't want to suppress, I don't want to suppress, but what is the appropriate reaction? How do we wisely work with anger?
Yeah, and we can all talk about this together. Yeah, I appreciate this is all of our experience, of course, and no suppression, we absolutely don't want to, this is not about pushing away. This is the path is the opposite. It's about moving towards intimacy. We become intimate. So we just get close to our anger and we let it do its dance. That doesn't mean that we can let it do its dance without acting on it, you know. We can let it do its dance so we get really familiar. We get, you know, we just invite it in because it's like nature. It's part of us. It's enlivening to us. So we don't hate, you know, we don't hate our anger. It's like really respecting its force, really respecting its force. And I think that, like what you said, is important, that wisdom and compassion, I think, are a deeper, more sustaining, more powerful force than anger. So that's helpful for me to remember. I know that just in my own little experience. So when I, you know, but sometimes I have to act out of anger because it's all I have. You know, I can't, you know, there's nowhere else to go. You know, I'm thinking of like my husband, when things never get said because I'm not in a good space to say it, then I end up never saying anything. So it's like, no, okay, I'm angry and I'm just going to say it, you know, I'm going to figure that out. But I know that compassion and wisdom have so much more, there's more teeth, there's more power, and it can be sustained. It doesn't exhaust us. I think anger exhausts us. And it hurts. It hurts us and it hurts people. So, yeah.
Just to help, do you have any recommendations about maybe things to read or learn more about on how to turn anger into grace?
Thich Nhat Hanh is an author that I just feel like understands anger very well. You know, he was someone involved in the Vietnam War, you know, and saw atrocious things and lived with so many insults, but he doesn't display. I mean, he is walking peace, that man. I studied with him in Plum Village. He's just a beautiful creature. But he talks about working with his anger when he's in diplomatic situations, and he talks about his very specific process. So it's, you know, and he details it beautifully. So I would recommend Thich Nhat Hanh.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'll just add that I find when I'm confronting anger that it usually is guiding me to understand something in my core values that are being offended, mm-hmm. and why, and it helps me to understand if I'm going to act on it at this point or act on it at another time, or find some other way to deal with it, but to get to the point where this is offending my core values,
yes.
And what are those values?
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that, because that was sort of what I included, why I was so angry at this teacher. It was like, you know, why did he have any power over me? Is there something in the way he used his words that was offending my core values, is offending my sense of self, my principled self, you know? So there's this sense of self, but I think principles are good. But again, it's like knowing the difference between being discerning and being angry. So we can tease those out. Like, we can see clearly where action needs to happen, or, you know, we can see clearly sometimes if we feel like someone is just misguided in their thinking or, you know, whatever. But it's a separate, there's no problem with that. The problem is with the concomitant emotions that don't serve. Yeah.
I'm reminded of a time I asked this question about can anger be good, and the response was, I don't really remember, but I think maybe the Dalai Lama explaining how there's a difference between anger of compassion and anger of the ego, and trying to claim root in that compassion which goes with the wisdom.
Yeah, thank you.
I think this anger thing is pretty complicated. I try to look at the situation that I'm in. If I express anger in this situation, what's the downfall? Is there a group of other people that are going to be affected? It's very complicated, I think. And at times, one of the most important things that I try to do is watch it, observe it, and then I have this thing where I leave the situation rather than to say it or to explode. And I kind of call it kicking stones. I go out and kick stones somewhere. And you know, just whether it's a walk around the block or a week of really kicking stones, it kind of comes back. It can come back with, you do come back with some stuff. It is long, it is a core value thing. recently, it was interesting. I was chatting with my mother. She's 92. And I'm talking, and I looked at her, and she wasn't even listening. And I thought, I got kind of angry for a second. And I just went, oh, wait a minute. Maybe I don't have anything to say. Maybe, really, she doesn't care what I'm saying. And I thought, okay, that's okay. Because my core value is that the value was, people should listen to me. I have something to say. You know what? That's not true. That's really not true in all situations. So those of you who didn't hear that.
About the story you told, to finish it, like, so when you went in there with kind of softened heart and not such a judgmental place, what did you discover about this gentleman? Did he surprise you in any way? That was he different than you assumed? Or?
Yeah, I saw so much more. I saw that he was really trying to help me, and I saw that he was actually pretty shy. I saw all these things that I hadn't seen before because I was in a muddy place about it. I just saw, I had put him into a category. And I saw that he cared. Like, he really cared about my practice. And he offered good instruction. You know, so it was like all these things. So, yeah, I did see. And I saw tensions in his face I hadn't noticed before. And so there was just a whole different presence that I had with him. Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Another part of dealing with that anger that I've recently experienced is that in a work situation, of course, there's a lot of competition. And if I become very angry at one individual, there's almost a revenge factor that starts to build. And yet, if I can step back from that and say, where else is this going to spill over? Who else is this going to hurt? If I keep this anger, if I start plotting revenge for the anger, if I start just getting myself so worked up that I can't see straight, and if I start thinking about where does that spill over, that brings me back to seeing what's there, what's really there, and what really has to be dealt with. And again, you came out with the idea that a large part of it is simply being kind to yourself. And if you're working from kindness in yourself, you can respond to perceived slights or different points of view or blatant ignorance with kindness. But it takes, for me sometimes, it takes seeing where it would spread if it continues to fester.
One thing that I have come to is to just slowing down anger. And sometimes just asking myself some questions about what is it that I need? What is it that is, there may be a real issue that's involved, and anger won't help me communicate. And that there's something that I might need to say to someone that doesn't have much to do. There may be something I need to request from them. There may be something that I need to express to them. But it doesn't necessarily have to come with the high temperature. It can come at a lower temperature. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I want to say thank you for everything that you brought up. And, as far as anger is concerned, I appreciate that you stated that the only thing that can destroy hatred is love. Mm-hmm. And, when I look at anger in days past, I mean, I had a real way beyond anger thing. Was a rageful, it's not, anger was a goal to get to at one point, and it was all, not to get too involved here, but it was completely living in past with, a very rough experiences growing up and carrying that around with me. And, you know, having that behind my face when you're saying the kabuki, that having that there. And I think that the only thing that taught me that anger to me is like a flag in my life. And it's a flag that goes, my ego is incapable of accepting the reality of this present situation. And I say that again, my ego. And, you know, my ego, he's a very destructive person, yeah, destructive force in my life. The thing that brought tears to my eyes actually was the one that we laughed about when you said, a gang is chopping me, but, to love them, to go, I forgive them, to me, that's just such a beautiful concept to be able to even look at that, to behold that. And that's the only way. There's been nothing else that has worked in my life as far as anger is concerned. It has been love. And until I get to that point where I'm giving somebody compassion, active through my actions and my words and my kindness, there's been no... There's been no productivity from being right. Being right. Right, Schmeich. So, thank you for...
Let's all put that on our refrigerators. Right, Schmeich. Those are great final words. Let's all just settle in for a minute. I think I'd like to read a short poem called Kindness by Naomi Shihab Nye. This was written in 1978. Before you know what kindness really is, you must lose things, feel the future dissolve in a moment, like a salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop. The passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you learn the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in a white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he was, too, someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow, you must speak it, till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore, only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread, only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It is I you've been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. So let's just sit for a minute and let go of the words. Thanks for coming tonight.